32. Brooke swung her beige Mercedes into the sports pavilion back lot just after Asha. She parked and opened her car door. "Asha, wait," she called. "I'm here. Hold up." They entered the back door of the sports pavilion together. Grunge rock from the 90s was blasting. "Come on," Asha said. Brooke noticed she was wheezing and flushed. "Take it easy," Brooke said as they started up the stairs. "Slow down."
"I'm fine."
They looked around the upper level. The cardio machines were on one end, the weightlifting apparatus was in the center, and there was a mirror along the wall that faced the balcony, looking out over the basketball courts. At the far end was the door to the trainer's room. It was closed.
"Where is he?"
Asha asked, panicked eyes darting back and forth. "Good question," Brooke answered, taking a deep breath and trying to stay calm. She put a steadying hand on Asha's arm and said, "We'll find them." After a momentary hesitation, Asha headed towards the other side of the mezzanine. Brooke followed. Asha knocked on the training room door.
"Hello? Anybody in there?"
Inside the room, something dropped and hit the floor, but no one responded. Brooke tried to open the door and realized it was locked. She rattled the knob, yelling, "Who's in there? Sloane? Are you in there?" There was a noise from the other side of the door, but it was faint. No voices, only a hint of movement.
"Oh, for fuck's sake, who's in there? Open the door!"
With that, the door immediately opened. Nick slid out gingerly, one finger to his lips, as if he'd just successfully put an infant down for a nap. "Shh." He quietly pulled the door closed behind him, taking the women in with an expression of dismay and disapproval, as if they were the problem.
"What's the ruckus?"
They both stared at him.
"Ruckus?" Asha asked. "You want to know what's the ruckus? Is Sloane in there?" Brooke demanded.
"Can you lower your voice, please?"
he asked calmly, slipping his phone into his shorts pocket.
"Why?" Brooke asked. "The music is ear-splitting. Just answer me. Is Sloane in there?"
"The music is just white noise. And yes, she's in there. We were doing her 10-minute guided meditation, and she fell asleep. I decided to let her rest. There are so many demands on her coming from so many different directions right now. Sometimes they just need a safe space to relax."
"Move," Brooke said.
He put his back against the door.
"Just be patient. She was already waking up. I'm sure she'll be out in a minute."
Asha was staring at Nick, unblinking, oval-eyed, jaw clenched.
"Mia told me about your intervention."
"Oh, did she?"
Nick smiled in a way that indicated he was fine with that.
"Yes," Asha answered, undeterred. "She begged me not to talk to you about it. Said it was a secret, that you'd threatened to turn her into the police. Do you want to explain?"
"It's called mentoring," he said. "That's what you hired me for, isn't it? You both wanted a personal trainer and a mentor for your daughters, and that's all I've tried to do, help them. Sometimes I use slightly unconventional methods, but that's how I get results. That's how you create strong competitors who can succeed in the real world. Your daughters needed guidance, and I provided it."
Brooke banged again on the door.
"Sloane, answer me. Are you in there?"
"Mom?"
Sloane's voice was slurred. Brooke gave Nick an unexpected shove, grabbed the doorknob, and pushed the door open. Sloane was sitting in a plastic chair by the back of the room behind the training table. She was bent over, attempting to tie one of her shoelaces. It wasn't going very well. Her body was swaying from side to side, as if she was about to faceplant off the chair. Brooke wheeled around towards Nick.
"What the hell is going on here?"
she asked, her voice quiet yet ferocious.
"What do you mean?"
he asked, crossing his arms on his chest and appearing to be totally puzzled.
"Brooke," Asha said appalled. "Oh my God, he did something."
Nick said,
"Okay, come on now, don't be ridiculous."
He shook his head and laughed.
"Sloane's fine. She fell asleep. Mrs. Wilson, I think you need to sit down. The bench press is just over here, and given your condition, you should relax and—"
"Stop that," Asha said. "Stop acting like we don't understand what is right in front of our eyes. We're not stupid. We'll see what the police make of you taking my daughter into an empty house with you last night when you were supposed to be bringing her home. We'll see what they make of this. You, behind a locked door with a 15-year-old girl who is clearly under the influence of something.
You're out of your mind, he responded.
Oh, shut up, Nick, Brooke said, reaching out to pull the door to the training room shut again. What are you doing, Brooke? Asha asked.
I don't want Sloane to hear what I'm about to say.
Nick raised his eyebrows.
All right, ladies, let's just back this up a little. I can see you're both very upset.
Did you touch her? Brooke asked. Nick held up his hands incredulously.
What?
Brooke repeated herself.
Did you touch her? No, of course I didn't.
You're lying. You're going to go to jail for this, Brooke said. Nick laughed, and he looked boyish somehow, like a kid who'd been caught.
No, you don't understand.
I think we do understand, Asha said, and I think the police will understand as well.
Nick clapped his hands together as if he were standing in front of a class. Okay, let's run with this then. I have two girls who've been entrusted to me by their parents to help get them into a good college, and both of these girls are drinking, doing drugs, sneaking out at night, trespassing and throwing parties in other people's homes, and sending X-rated photos of themselves to all the boys in the school, and yet,
he rolled his eyes towards the ceiling.
And yet, the moms are mad at me for stepping in and trying to help?
Not Mia, Asha said. She didn't send around photos. I don't believe you. Mia didn't do that.
They all do that,
Nick said, pulling his phone out of his pocket and clicking on his camera roll. He extended it so Asha could see.
Here's a nice one. There's that cute silver dragonfly ring Mia always wears. I've got more if you want.
Give it to me, Asha said.
My phone? No, that's okay. I'll hold on to it. But if you want to have a look, there it is.
Asha's hand dropped into her purse, and she pulled her stun gun out of it. She dipped her shoulder and dropped the purse to the ground so she could more easily hold the taser like a pistol. It was pointed at Nick's chest.
Give it to me, Mrs. Wilson, he said. Do you even know how to use—
Give it to me, she shouted, lunging forward. Her baby bump made her ungainly, and she tripped. As Nick jumped backwards, she fired the electrode wires downwards, just missing his thigh. Still, she managed to cause him to drop the phone. Brooke dove in, scooped it up, and looked at the screen. She swiped a couple of times, her face turning red and enraged.
You're both out of control, he said. This is going to end badly. I'd like my phone back, please.
Brooke turned the screen of the phone towards Nick and said, These photos weren't taken at a party. These aren't sexy selfies, she spit. You took these. Brooke pointed at the training room.
In there. And that's the back of your hairy hand pulling Sloane's shirt to the side just now while she was passed out.
Nick darted forward and grabbed his phone back.
Wrong, he said. You are way, way off base. How dare you insinuate such a disgusting thing when all I've done is try to help.
Shut up, Brooke said, and used the right hook she'd perfected in her title boxing workouts to smash the left side of his face with her fist. He staggered backwards into the squat rack, and the back of his head smacked into one of the upper hooks. He let out a pained, ugh, and looked surprised when he touched the spot and brought his hand away. His middle three fingers were red with bright, shiny blood. For a second, it looked like maybe his knees were going to give, but then he staggered a few steps to the side so he could lean against the balcony.
Huh, well, I think that seals the deal, doesn't it? I guess now we know who's really going to jail,
he said nonchalantly.
I'm done with you two. Goodbye, ladies.
No, Asha said, sounding almost conversational. She had moved to a place beyond hysteria. All she felt was resolve. You're not going to just walk away. Nick wiped the blood from his fingers off on his t-shirt and gave her a skeptical smile.
Come on. Really? The parents here love me. They respect me. I've been doing this job all over the country for 2 decades without a single complaint. Sloane and Mia are delinquents, drinkers, promiscuous potheads. The last thing you want is for those photos of your daughters to suddenly find their way into the inboxes of every Falcon family. Am I right? So watch me. Watch me walk away.
Asha dropped the taser, which only had one charge in it to begin with, in order to attack him with both hands. They went for him at the same time, and with the combination of Brooke's strength and Asha's 170 pounds of baby weight, he went over the balcony fairly easily. Brooke leaned out and looked down at his body, which was as horribly contorted as if it had been thrown from a terrible car accident, a crash dummy smashed up on the court. Let's see you walk away from that, motherfucker. 33. An hour later, after Natalie had woken in her snow-covered car and discovered her own footprints, she stood in the hallway outside the basketball courts. It hurt her brain trying to piece together what had happened earlier when she'd come into the sports pavilion. She remembered hearing Nick's voice. He'd been training Sloane and shouting encouragement in that fatherly way of his. Sloane was laughing, all tinkly and light and girlish. Natalie had felt queasy with envy and regret. She'd known then, suddenly, that she would never be the one to laugh with him again like that. Their time was finished. And after that? What? Natalie struggled to find the memory. Nothing was there, except she'd been very, very angry. The sports pavilion felt empty. No sounds. No movement. There was no sign of Nick, but his truck was still in the parking lot. He had to be there somewhere, even if she couldn't smell his icy hot or cologne. She took a few steps toward the darkened gym, her pulse quickening as she began to suspect that something was wrong, and she was totally alone. Some sixth sense was drawing her towards the doors. Natalie curled her hand, leaned in, and made a cup for her eyes against one of the rectangular windows. It took a second to see anything at all. The court was dim, aglow only from the small green emergency lights situated over the doors and in the corners of the room. Her eyes were adjusting. Something was there. She jumped away from the door as if the glass had burned her skin. Her hands flew up to cover her mouth. A scream almost escaped, but she stopped it in her throat with a choking noise. Not far from the door was what looked like a crumpled pile of clothes and broken body parts, motionless in the middle of what appeared to be a spreading pool of blood. What the hell did I do? After a second, Natalie crept back to the window, forcing herself to look again, trying not to cry. Whatever it was, it remained motionless. Until it didn't. She could see then that it was a body, and one arm was reaching out slowly. Vertigo hit her hard, and she grabbed onto the big metal push bar to hold herself upright. After a second, she gathered her courage and opened the door. There was a smell, sweat, copper, and something fetid. She started inching closer, approaching as if the dark heap on the floor might be a bomb that could go off at any second. There was a dark mass. Her first impression had been right. Blood. One step closer, and she knew, with gut-wrenching certainty. It was Nick, splayed at the edge of the basketball court. He wore a blue shirt, sports shorts, socks, and trainers. He was on his stomach, and the hair on the back of his head was all matted and sticky. Nick, she whispered. He didn't answer. Oh, Christ, she whispered. Her own footprints in the snow leading from her car to the door and then back were suddenly all she could see, dark spots at the edges of her vision. The crevices in the hardwood maple floor had become thin, black streams, slowly spreading out in straight lines and right angles. No, she said, feeling more helpless and hopeless than she ever had before in her life. He turned his head. One eye was swollen almost completely shut, but she could see a sliver of white. His mouth, those once perfectly shaped lips, moved slightly.
Natalie,
he managed.
Cole,
he said, his words sounding like mud in his mouth.
9-1.
His fingers fluttered. She didn't even have a purse with her, and her phone was gone. Her hands were empty. Useless. He made a weak gesture. Natalie looked over and saw his cell. She hadn't noticed it because the phone was black and it was screened down in his blood, only 6 inches away from his hand. I've got it, she said, picking it up. It was all she could do to hold onto it. She was trembling so violently. She wiped the blood off on her skirt so that she could see the screen. It was spiderwebbed with cracks, but the phone seemed to be functioning. She typed in his passcode, 2258, but she messed it up and it didn't work. Her hands weren't doing what she wanted them to do. She tried again. Still nothing. Was she in shock? Nick managed to whisper.
Natalie?
I'm here, she said, her voice ragged.
It's okay.
She wasn't looking at him, but she heard him breathing in a labored way, as if there were something stuck in his throat. He sounded like he was in terrible pain.
Help me,
he managed, though it barely sounded like words.
Please.
I'm trying to. I will. I promise. I'm trying. Her frustration was mounting, making it hard to concentrate. There was a clamor in her head, and she could hear herself repeating the words. Come on, come on, come on. The third time she typed in the code 2258, the phone opened back up to the camera, which must have been in use at the time of Nick's fall. Natalie was about to close the camera and bring up the number pad to call for help when the icon in the lower left corner caught her eye. It was a miniature image of the last photo taken in the roll, and it was a flesh-colored close-up. Even with it being that small, Natalie had a feeling she knew what it was. She touched it, bringing it up on the screen. Everything came to a stop. She was looking at Sloane. There was very little background, but Natalie recognized the taupe-colored cushion on the cot in the training room. The girl appeared to be asleep, and it was a photo that should never have been taken. At first, Natalie didn't understand what she was seeing. After that, disbelief. Then outrage. She swiped again to be sure, and again. There were probably a dozen, and then there were more after that of Mia with the same blurry background also asleep. Natalie stopped scrolling. She'd seen enough. Rather than calling for an ambulance, Natalie put the phone back down where she'd found it. You're sick, she said, nearly falling backwards in her haste to get away.
I'll be okay,
he said in a hoarse voice out the side of his mouth.
If you help.
I'm not helping you. Nick's shattered body moved slightly, and he cried out in agony. He was able to crawl a couple of inches, moaning with each minuscule movement. She waited to see if he was going to be able to get to it, and when the phone was almost within his grasp, she used the tip of her boot to nudge it away from his outstretched hand. Nick didn't give up. He flung his arm out ahead like a swimmer, placed his palm against the shiny surface, and tried to drag himself forward yet again. A tortured roar came out of his mouth at an impressive volume for a man in his condition. He reached for the phone, and this time he came very close. Natalie made a decision. She kicked it away a second time and then brought the heel of her boot down on it with enormous force. Nick looked like he wanted to say something else, but he gave up. He put his head back down on the floor and closed his eyes. Natalie stood there, waiting for something to happen. Nothing did. Where was the chaos? Not in her head, as she might have expected. She felt sleepy and sated, as if she'd just finished a rich and delicious snack. 34. Natalie didn't try to sleep that night, not even for a few minutes. What was the point? Inside the bathroom, she'd curled up on the floor of the shower with the water running, hoping to keep the neighbors from hearing her crying. At 7 in the morning, she ordered herself to go through the motions. Get showered, brush teeth. She gagged on the toothbrush and dry-heaved over the toilet. Put on clothes. She chose a high-collared dress and ankle boots. No lipstick. Not a day for drawing attention. After extracting the blood-stained skirt from her laundry basket, she carried it with two fingers, like she had a dead rodent by the tail, into the kitchen. She rinsed it, placed it in a Target bag from under the sink, tied it up in a knot, and left it down there behind the dishwasher pods, bleach, and sponges. Out of sight, out of mind. Coffee. Toast. As it turned out, toast was not a good idea. Don't fall over. Don't get back in bed. Natalie had one last look in the bathroom mirror. There was nothing more she could do. She took a pill to help her stay on her feet after the restless night and washed it down with some water from the sink. As she passed the garbage dumpster in the parking lot on the way to her car, she was reminded of the corporeal smell of fresh human blood leaking, pooling, and congealing. She covered her mouth with her hand, swallowed down the foul taste of total desperation, and hoped for the best. A dozen or so teachers had gathered in front of the academic building. As if focused on a theatrical performance, they were all quiet, with their eyes looking in the exact same direction. The lawn outside the sports pavilion was a hornet's nest of frenetic activity. There were blue uniforms, orange coveralls, and several people in identical outfits of khaki pants and black jackets. All of them were frowning, serious, and busy. Men and women marched authoritatively back and forth between patrol cars and the front entrance to the pavilion, and all of them seemed to be mumbling into their shoulders where their radios were clipped. Two officers were stationed on either side of the front doors. One lifted and lowered the yellow tape across the entrance to the sports pavilion so people could come and go. It was like a bizarre game of limbo, with police contorting to duck underneath. The second officer stood there with a pad and paper, keeping some sort of log. Yvonne raised her arm up over the heads of the teachers and motioned Natalie over. She was standing between the flagpole and the bronze statue of the school mascot, a falcon with giant wings and a lethal beak. "Hi," Natalie said, instinctively slipping her arm through Yvonne's. "What's all this?" she asked, wondering if her friend would detect the hint of fear in her voice.
"The story is, as of yet," Yvonne whispered, "still unfolding."
"That's a lot of police officers," Natalie whispered back.
"I know."
A white wisp escaped from the corner of Yvonne's mouth. She'd been sneaking a quick vape.
Do you know what happened?"
"No,"
Yvonne said, her voice breathy with drama.
"Police showed up. There'd been a 911 call. The cops arrived, and Rex walked them to the sports pavilion. I wasn't here yet, but Rex said two ambulances showed up, and two stretchers came out the front door."
"Two?" Natalie exclaimed, her eyes popping open in alarm. She looked away self-consciously and told herself to shut up, shut up, shut up.
"Two."
Yvonne took one last puff and put the jewel back in her pocket. After exhaling, she cupped one hand to the side of her mouth and said quietly,
"I heard the phrase, puddle of blood, from one of the teachers."
Some of Natalie's coffee shot up her throat and filled her mouth. She cringed visibly and plunged her ice-cold fingers deep into her fluffy pockets. They slid across silk.
"Oh, dear God,"
she said out loud. She'd completely forgotten. The necktie was still right there where she'd shoved it the previous evening. A flood of emotion caused tears to spring to her eyes. It was wadded into a little silken ball in her pocket, like crumpled tissue.
"Are you okay?"
Yvonne asked.
"I'm just cold,"
Natalie answered, her teeth beginning to clack uncontrollably in her mouth.
"I think they'll let us go inside soon,"
Yvonne said. She took off her own scarf and draped it around Natalie's shoulders.
"Let's go see what they say."
"Thank you," Natalie said, twining it twice around her neck and over her chin, concealing almost all of her face. She lowered her head and followed Yvonne, hoping no one would look at her, home in on her eyes, and realize that she was terrified.
"Get ready," Jay said, pointing out the window. "Here comes another. How many is that now?"
He looked at his dog, who was perched on the thick arm of the big old recliner at full alert, trembling with the excitement and horror of the morning. They watched another police car go racing by. Rocky growled, low and steady, his hackles rising between his shoulders. Jay sat in that spot looking down at the valley often, out of boredom and a nosy curiosity about the vacationers who rented out the condominiums across the way. Today, he was glued to the window, simultaneously patting Rocky and smoking a joint. For the last hour, the police had been zipping back and forth on the main road, just down the mountain from where Jay's rental house was located. The epicenter of activity was definitely in the vicinity of Falcon Academy, where Natalie worked. Rocky whined as a new siren wailed in the distance.
"It's okay, Rocky dog,"
Jay said, but he was almost 100% sure that wasn't actually true. He hoped to God there wasn't a shooter at the school, and he kept scrolling the news on his phone. Nothing. He started texting Natalie.
"Worried about you. Are you in a safe place?"
Jay took a drag from his joint and re-listened to the voicemail his sister had left him the previous night. She'd called from her landline, which was strange, and said,
"Jay, are you awake? Can you talk? I did something I shouldn't have done. Oh man, I'm screwed. Call me at home.
And now this. Looking out the window, he half suspected a helicopter to arrive and hover over the village while soldiers rappelled to the ground. There was a chance, he supposed, that Natalie had done what he'd suggested and just punched that guy right in the face. He hoped not. As difficult as it was for him to imagine how a breakup argument, even one that included a flying fist from his little sister, could wind up shutting down an entire school, he thought it was possible. He didn't know how much she'd had to drink the previous day, but he did know that she'd been out of control and enraged, and for that reason he was worried. If it came to a showdown between a legendary Falcon Academy coach and the unsophisticated young office assistant he'd been sleeping with on the sly, it would be no question who people would believe. 35. Mr. Dilly suspended school for the day. For the next couple of hours, Yvonne and Natalie ran about between the office, the school lobby, and the entrance foyer, ferrying students out to their nannies, drivers, and parents. By the time there was a lull in the traffic, Natalie was perspiring enough to worry about stains seeping through the fabric of her light blue dress. She went to the bathroom and splashed water on her face. The whites around her eyes were spiderwebbed with thin red threads. The sight made her think of the blood that had been slowly seeping its way down the thin cracks between the boards of the basketball court. Back at her computer, her intercom buzzed.
Natalie?
Yes, Mr. Dilly, she answered.
Could you ask Rex to come into the study?
Of course, right away.
I heard him,
Rex said, standing up in a way that suggested he resented being asked to do so. He shuffled past Natalie and into the back of the office, towards the study. Headmaster Dilly's playlist of classical favorites was piped at a soothing volume throughout the office, and Natalie, who had never found it irritating before, wanted to rip the speakers off the walls. She considered the possibility that this might be the onset of a migraine. Searing, ripping, horrendous pain throbbed in the back of her head, in the same spot where she'd seen that golf ball-sized hole peeking out through Nick's hair. She glanced over at her winter coat hanging on the rack in the corner next to Mr. Dilly's charcoal herringbone wool trench. Her eyes dropped to the pocket. She stood, walked over, and retrieved the necktie. She crammed it under the plastic tray towards the back of her desk drawer, hiding it with the other things she didn't want anyone to find. Yvonne, busy scrolling through Instagram posts at her own computer, didn't even look up. Natalie had just sat back down at her desk when Rex returned from the study and left through the side door, trudging down the hallway towards the classrooms. Natalie glanced at Yvonne, who shrugged and mouthed, I don't know.
Girls?
Natalie nearly jumped out of her skin when Mr. Dilly appeared behind her.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't mean to startle you.
He was accompanied by a tall woman and a wide man, both nicely dressed in suit jackets and dark pants.
Natalie, Yvonne, this is Beth Larson and Ken Bradley. They are detectives from the Major Crimes Division in Denver.
Both detectives extended their hands, first to Yvonne and then to Natalie. The woman was middle-aged, with grayish-blonde hair in a low-maintenance pixie cut and icy blue piercing Nordic eyes.
Call me Beth, she said.
Okay, Natalie said, glancing at Mr. Dilly, who she had been calling Mr. Dilly for a year, and who had never once asked her to call him Mark. Beth? Ken was black and bald, with a charismatic smile and cheerful round cheeks.
I hear you ladies are sort of the eyes and the ears of the school,
Ken said. Before Natalie and Yvonne could answer, they were interrupted by the arrival of the athletic director, Lars Jaeger, who was waving a piece of paper.
I've got it, he said. The register of the weekend privates as requested. You know where to find me if you need anything else?
Yes, thanks,
Ken answered, passing the paper to his partner. As Lars left, Rex returned to the front office after a notable absence. He walked in and stood there silently, his arms hanging motionless at the sides of his meaty hips. The expression on his face was hostile, and his eyes seemed to be boring into Natalie. He cleared his throat, and as simple as that was, it sounded like an accusation. Natalie couldn't help herself. Rex, is everything?
Rex is taking us down to the health and safety chamber to look at the CCTV footage from yesterday,
Mr. Dilly cut in. Everything at the school had a fancy name. The student cafeteria was referred to as the Falcon's Roost Cafe. The health and safety chamber, which sounded like it was part of NASA, was a walk-in closet filled with computers.
We'll be, what, about an hour, Rex?
Rex said, sure, still staring at Natalie. After they walked away, it was all she could do not to verbally command the room to stop spinning. It felt like she was about to swallow her tongue. She nodded and reached out with one hand to steady herself on her desk. The CCTV footage would show her going in and out of the sports pavilion twice the previous evening. It would likely confirm that she was the last person to leave the school, at least the last who wasn't brought out on a stretcher. At the desk adjacent to Natalie's, Yvonne's mobile kept vibrating. She was receiving all sorts of texts from teachers speculating about what had happened in the gym.
Rohan thinks there was an accident with a student, and the school is trying to keep it on the down low, Yvonne whispered to Natalie, who didn't answer. But Gail thinks there was a fight, not an accident.
Does anyone know who died? Natalie asked. Has anyone said who the... She swallowed. Who the two people were?
Two, right?
It seems like there were definitely two.
Two,
Yvonne confirmed.
Probably two people who got in an argument, don't you think?
Yes, probably. Natalie closed her eyes very tight and just let her fingers rest on the computer keyboard, where she was supposed to be typing up a flyer about donations of canned food for Thanksgiving. Who else had been in the building when she saw him lying there bleeding from his head? Who had been there watching, hiding in the dark? Or worse, who else had been hurt? Who else had been suffering, possibly dying, in some other part of the gym? It was as if she were back in the sports pavilion. Natalie could taste it in her sour mouth, like two dirty fingers down her throat. There had been the usual lingering funk of sweaty teenagers. Their adolescent pheromonal stench sank into the mats and the practice jerseys. But in her nose now was the porta-potty smell of sewage, blood and piss, shit, fear and death. Natalie considered pulling the office trash can over and putting her head in it. Yvonne was oblivious. What were they looking at right now? Right down the hall. What were they seeing on that surveillance footage? God, she was perspiring. How wide was the scope of the security camera? Was it a close shot on the back door, so just her going in and out? Or was it a wide frame, featuring her staggering pell-mell, wasted, across the parking lot like a zombie screaming for brains? Was it something worse that she couldn't possibly even imagine? It seemed the time had come to consider all her options. One, there was the truth. Two, there was the possibility of standing up and walking out the front door, dashing to her car, and escaping to some seedy motel where she would have to ask her brother to bring cash and a burner phone and hide forever. Three, and finally, there was lying. Lie like her life depended on it. Natalie looked up and saw Oliver Wilson running down the hall, a panicked look in his eyes, followed by Mia, who came rushing into the office.
Something wrong, kids? Yvonne asked, standing. My dad ordered us an Uber, Mia answered. We have to leave. Something bad has happened and we have to go, and we have to go now.
Outside in the car park, a handful of children were being dismissed into a line of cars by their teachers. A black sedan cut to the front and pulled to a stop. Mia glanced at her phone.
That's him,
she said to Oliver, who looked like he was putting all his effort into not crapping his pants.
This isn't how we do it, Yvonne said. This isn't school policy. I'm sorry, Mia said, pushing Oliver towards the door. We have to get to the hospital right away. It's my mom.
It's your mom? What? The blood drained from Natalie's face. What happened to your mom?
I don't know yet, Mia answered. I didn't see her this morning. But,
Yvonne pointed to the parental sign-out sheet.
Are we just supposed to let you walk out?
Mia didn't bother to respond, and seconds later, she had steered Oliver out of the school and down the sidewalk to the awaiting sedan. She opened the back door, threw her brother's things inside, and gave him a shove. She climbed in behind him, and the sedan pulled away from the curb at a high speed, going the wrong way through the entrance. Natalie and Yvonne stood there in stunned silence. Eventually, Yvonne said,
Oh my God, oh my God!
She turned to Natalie and patted her own cheeks like the kid from Home Alone.
What was that?
I have no idea.
Aren't you friendly with your mom?
Sort of, Natalie answered. I was. I mean, I am. Do you think something happened to Asha Wilson?
Yes. The answer had slipped out, but it was true. Natalie turned to look down the hall, expecting to see them coming for her. It was just Mr. Dilly on his own. When he threw open the front office door, he said,
Natalie, the detectives want to speak with you in the health and safety chamber.
Some sort of strange instinct for self-preservation took over in the form of a massive adrenaline rush, and she decided to go with choice number 3.
Lie like you believe it, like you are the best liar ever.
Okay, she said, surprised to find that she sounded more or less normal. As she walked away from her desk, she glanced over at Rex. He made a point of looking away out the window. The hallway leading to the large closet that contained the surveillance equipment seemed endless. She rubbed her tattoo with her fingers and took short, shallow breaths as she went over some things to remember.
Eye contact. Don't fidget. Don't fold your arms over your chest. Don't protest too much. Keep it simple.
The door to the room was closed. She knocked.
Come in, Beth called.
Natalie opened the door and stepped inside. Ken was seated at a small desk in front of 6 monitors mounted on the wall, looking at his phone. He ignored her. To Beth, he said,
The crime scene technician just arrived. He's over in the gym now.
Is it Pete? Beth asked.
It is.
Good, Beth answered.
She was also seated, facing Natalie. There was no other chair in the room. To be fair, there really wasn't room for one. Beth pointed and said,
Close the door behind you, please.
After a second, Ken put his phone away, looked up, and folded his hands in his lap. There was a keyboard, hard drive, and laptop on the desk. Ken pressed a button and then pointed at one of the many monitors.
Who's that?
He asked, pointing to a woman wearing a coat with fluffy white fur at the collar and wrists. The woman walked into frame from the parking lot behind the sports pavilion and entered the back door of the building. Not only was the coat unusual, but it was currently hanging on a rack by her desk. There was nothing else Natalie could say except,
That's me.
You go in at 4:08, and then 10 minutes later you go back out. At 6:12 p.m. you go in again. At 6:32 you leave for the second time. Can you tell me what you were doing and who you saw?
I was looking for my earbuds. I didn't see anyone.
Ken raised an eyebrow.
Looking for your earbuds? Okay. Twice?
Yes, Natalie said, nodding. That's right.
Did you find them?
Not the first time, but the second time I did. I thought I'd left them in the little cup holder on the treadmill on the mezzanine, but they weren't there. I couldn't find them anywhere else, so I went back later to look again and realized they'd fallen behind the machine.
Beth opened a small notebook and jotted something down. She passed the notebook to Ken.
Do you have your phone with you?
He asked.
I'd like to have a quick look at it, if you don't mind.
I lost my phone Saturday night at the Fall Feast.
At the what?
Ken asked.
At the Fall Feast? It's a school thing, a fancy dinner for upperclassmen and faculty.
Ken and Beth shared a look. Natalie felt as if she were facing a firing squad. Beth passed Ken another note. He read it and said,
What were you going to do with your earbuds if you'd lost your phone?
Nothing, I just wanted to find them.
But you spent all that time and effort coming to the school twice, when you could have just looked for them this morning when you came to work.
They were expensive.
All right,
Ken said, readjusting his large body in the small chair. His new posture was tilted towards Natalie.
So, let me tell you something about me.
What's that? She asked politely, though the absolute last thing in the world she wanted was to get to know him better.
I spent 4 years as a polygraph examiner in Memphis. I've probably heard more confessions than a priest.
Ken rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
I've given tons of polygraph exams. You know how they work?
A little line goes squiggly if you lie, Natalie answered. That's what I know, from those true crime shows.
Yeah, well, there's lots more to it. The bands around your chest tell me how fast your heart is beating. The chair has motion sensors that tell me if you fidget or flinch. The blood pressure cuff is self-explanatory. But you know what I always found the most telling?
I don't know.
The finger cuffs. They measure something called electrodermal activity. Do you know what that is?
Something to do with the skin, I guess, she answered, finding that the urge to inch away from him was getting too strong to ignore.
Yes, electrodermal activity is how much you sweat, Natalie.
Oh, she said, taking a tiny step backwards.
This is a pretty cold-ass closet we're hanging out in here, and yet your face is all shiny, and there's a little bead of sweat dripping down the side of your nose, like you're on a chaise lounge relaxing on the beach in Mexico.
Really? She didn't know what else to say. Sorry.
Sorry for what? For lying to me about losing your phone? For lying about losing your earbuds?
No, I did lose my stuff. I'm sorry for being so... This was ridiculous. What was she even doing? She had no recollection of what had happened the first time she'd gone into the gym because she'd been zonked out on a heartbreak binge of beer, uppers, and downers, and they were going to find out one way or another. How long could she play dumb? Natalie swallowed and finished her sentence. I'm sorry for being so sweaty. Ken sighed loudly and stood up. The room shrank. Natalie took another infinitesimal step backwards, and this time her back hit the door.
Well, he said casually, as if it was simply time for him to get going.
We're going to search your desk and purse and other personal items now.
What? Natalie couldn't believe it. She was stammering. This was exactly what she'd warned herself not to do. What?
You heard me, he said. You signed away your right to privacy at the workplace when you took this job.
It was true, and she had no choice but to bite her tongue. Natalie trailed a few feet behind Beth and Ken as they returned to the front office. Every few seconds, she looked side to side, as if searching for a window large enough to jump through, smashing the glass so she could go sprinting into the woods behind the stadium. In the end, she stood there silently alongside her workstation as Beth produced a pair of latex gloves from a pouch on her belt and began to rifle through Natalie's things. Yvonne watched the whole spectacle from behind her desk, rapt and silent, while Rex pretended nothing at all unusual was happening. A minute later, Mr. Dilly appeared and began observing as well. First, Beth went through Natalie's purse, which she kept underneath her desk, with her gym bag. Eventually, Beth seemed satisfied that neither contained anything of interest. Then she began to search the drawers. Tiny white flurries like snowflakes began to sprinkle softly through the periphery of Natalie's vision, and she realized that this was a first for her, a first time for feeling woozy and seeing stars. In the top drawer, Beth found Natalie's planner. She turned it over in her hands, curiously, and then took a long look at Natalie. The notebook was Winnie the Pooh themed, and Natalie did not look like a Winnie the Pooh woman, with her severely blunt bangs and a rebellious set to her jaw. After a cursory glance at a few pages in the middle of the planner, Beth said, I'm going to need this photocopied. She looked around and spoke broadly to everyone. You do have a photocopier, correct?
Yes, Mr. Dilly answered, sounding miserable. We do. Yvonne will help you.
It took Beth all of 2 minutes to work her way through the rest of Natalie's desk. Eventually, she pulled out the plastic organizer tray from the top drawer. The cascade of stars became absolutely torrential as Beth discovered the necktie and 7 oval-shaped pills, 4 orange and 3 white. She placed the items on top of the desk and went to the coat rack, where Natalie's fluffy, floral, 1970s-era steel of a coat was hanging. This is what you were wearing last night in the video, I take it? She asked, touching the sleeve. It is. Beth went through the pockets and produced a few dirty tissues, 3 red and white peppermint candies, an empty candy wrapper, and a post-it that said, Bacon, Flamin' Hot Doritos, and Ice Cream. Beth held it up and asked with a smirk, Shopping list? For my brother, Natalie clarified, feeling immediately like a first-class moron. Why was she bothering to tell these people that it was Jay who loved junk food, not her? They'd just found drugs in her drawer. Beth turned to Ken. I think that's it. Ken looked down at the items on the desk.
So, what do we have here, Natalie? A few opioids and a few amphetamines? Is that what they are?
Natalie nodded and said, Yes. Again, there was no point in denying something so easy to prove.
Do you have a prescription for these? Don't bother lying. I can find out in 5 minutes.
No.
So where did you get them?
She was not about to tell them she'd helped herself to the student prescriptions kept under lock and key in the nurse's office. The lost and found. And with that, she finally had Rex's complete attention. He glanced over his shoulder, and his dark eyebrows leaped halfway up his forehead.
Okay, Ken said. I think I get it. You stole them out of what, backpacks, pockets?
Natalie couldn't look at Mr. Dilly. Yes.
And what about this tie? What's with the tie?
I stole it too, she answered. Now that she was going, it was like she couldn't stop. From the lost and found also? Beth asked. Yes, Natalie answered. She took a deep breath, mind spinning. It reminded me of someone. I thought maybe the tie belonged to him and, I don't know, I just took it. No good reason. Ken looked exasperated with her.
Are you a kleptomaniac or something?
I don't think I am, Natalie answered. Maybe I am. I don't know. I don't take things very often. After a second, Beth asked, Who did the tie remind you of? At first, Natalie didn't respond. Ken cupped his hand around his ear and said,
Pardon? Who?
My boyfriend, Natalie answered softly. My ex-boyfriend.
Okay, and who might that be? Ken asked. Name?
Yvonne looked absolutely confused. Natalie rolled her neck around once, and it was so quiet in the room that everyone heard it crack. Nicholas McGuire. Over by himself, Rex coughed suddenly and violently. Yvonne's face was scrunched up as if she were trying to work out an impossible math equation in her head.
May I?
Ken said to Beth, and she responded by wordlessly handing over her notebook. Ken licked the tip of his pointer finger and flipped through a couple of pages.
I'm going to read you the names of the people caught on the surveillance video who were in the gym yesterday. Assistant Athletic Director Nicholas McGuire, a Falcon Academy mom named Linda Leland, and her 17-year-old son, Reed. Reed's 15-year-old girlfriend, Sloane Elliman Holt, and Sloane's mother, Brooke Elliman. There was another Falcon mom in there, too, by the name of Asha Wilson. Some of these people had perfectly logical reasons to be there, and some didn't. What interested me most is you, and why you went in and out twice.
I was looking for my-
I know, Ken nodded sympathetically. The expensive earbuds.
He gave her a questioning, concerned look. His brow furrowed, and he seemed suddenly fatherly, kind.
But we're investigating a crime, Natalie. Something horrible has happened, and you went in and out of a blood-spattered gym twice yesterday. You're going to have to tell us the whole story, and nothing but.
36. It had started to snow again, and Natalie was watching the flurries come down through the window. The sky was a solid dull white, and if she hadn't been more or less imprisoned by the two detectives in the school conference room, she would have been checking the weather channel to see what sort of storm was on the way. It looked like it could be a bad one, especially since it was so early in the autumn, and the salt trucks and snow plows might have been underprepared. She turned away from the window to glance at the clock that hung behind her on the wall. They'd been done with the interview on camera for 20 minutes, and since then, no one had spoken. Ken was scrolling through what appeared to be a barrage of messages on his own phone, while Beth continued to sit quietly at the opposite end of the table, methodically going through the photocopied pages of Natalie's Winnie the Pooh planner. While Natalie stared at the female detective, who was so emotionlessly reading through descriptions of Natalie's most intimate desires, worst impulses, harrowing fears, and destructive insecurities, Beth looked up. Their eyes met. The expression on Beth's face was clinical. What are you? What is wrong with you? Natalie began to bite at a hangnail. Ken suddenly raised his phone to his ear.
Go on, he said. Uh-huh. Okay.
He hung up and said to Beth,
Pete's ready for us.
All right. She put the papers detailing the last 6 months of Natalie's life away in a slim leather binder that she then slipped into her bag. Ken said,
Natalie, we're going to have to go down to the sports pavilion for a little bit. We'd like you to stay here.
Again, Natalie looked over her shoulder at the clock.
Do you have somewhere urgent you need to be?
He asked, pushing his chair back to stand up. No. Natalie answered.
Good,
he said. Natalie glanced at the window and then at the door. Ken noticed and said,
I'm sure there's no need to mention this, but we're going to have a patrol officer just outside.
Am I under arrest then?
No,
Ken answered. But Is now the time that I need to get a lawyer involved? Ken shook his head and shrugged, looking like a disappointed dad.
If you feel that's best, Natalie, by all means, do what you need to do. I wasn't ready to head in that direction yet, but it's up to you. I thought we were just talking.
Oh, okay. But you made it sound like the patrol officer outside was there to stop me from leaving.
He's there to let us know if you decide you're no longer willing to cooperate with our request to stay put, so we can speak to you later if we need to.
Natalie rubbed her eyes with the heels of her hands. Right, got it. Thanks. Pete was the crime scene technician, and he had a pleasant, youthful face, black-rimmed glasses, and not very much hair. He wore his nerdiness with pride, evidently, as he had a pen in his shirt pocket, underneath which was a small ink stain. He waylaid the detectives with an enthusiasm that added to his aura of endearing geekiness.
I've got lots of interesting thoughts to share, he said cheerfully, meeting them at the entrance to the pavilion.
Ken responded,
There's a curse that says, may you live in interesting times. I guess I'd rather hear cut and dried, open and shut case. Interesting sounds complicated.
Beth laughed and gave her partner an indulgent glance. She wasn't nearly as talkative as Ken, but she appreciated his gift of gab. Well, Pete said, beckoning them to follow him as he walked down the hall.
There's a lot going on here. Let's just go over each thing as we come to it. We can start in the locker room.
Beth took out her little notebook. So, Pete said, presenting the locker room with a giant sweep of the arm as if he were unveiling a new work of art.
All of the employee locker combinations were on file, but when I tried to open Mr. McGuire's locker, his didn't work.
Taking the cap off her pen, Beth said, She made a note. Pete gave them an aw shucks shrug.
I was able to open it anyway, of course.
He led them to Nick's locker. On the top shelf, there was a yellow placard with a black number 1 on it. Behind the evidence placard were the usual items, deodorant, a hairbrush, and a bottle of ibuprofen, but also 3 small clear glass bottles with silver lids and no labels.
I don't like that, Ken said.
Me neither, Beth agreed. Ken glanced at Beth questioningly.
Anabolic steroids?
She shook her head. Dunno, maybe.
I've only seen photos of Mr. McGuire, Pete said, sliding his glasses up his nose. His physical appearance wouldn't indicate steroid use necessarily. Still, he certainly could have been dispensing them.
Beth made another note. Pete slipped on his latex gloves and reached in for one of the bottles. He held it up to the light.
We won't know what it is until we get the lab results, but it's unlabeled, so that might be an indication it's not on the up and up.
He said this wearing a giant grin, as if it was all incredibly entertaining, and he hoped they were enjoying it as much as he was.
Yes, it might, Ken said, nodding.
There are similar vials on the mezzanine floor in the trainer's room, Pete said. We'll get to that shortly. But those up there all do have labels. Ketorolac. That doesn't necessarily mean they contain ketorolac, of course, he laughed. But I don't need to tell you that.
Beth was writing again. She looked up at Pete. Ketorolac?
Yeah, Ken said. I was wondering that also. I'm not familiar with that drug.
No reason you would be. It's not restricted. It's a widely used NSAID comparable to ibuprofen. Very popular in the sports world. I was a little surprised to find it in a high school, even though it's common in colleges. But then again, a school like this? Anything goes, I guess. Even pro athlete-style shots.
I played college basketball and took anti-inflammatories, Beth said, but I never had anyone give me a shot.
Yeah, well, this type of ketorolac is administered by intramuscular injection in the hip, with a small syringe. There were some of those in the training room. I'll test those, too.
It's not over-the-counter, is it?
Ken asked.
No, but like I said, it's not a controlled substance, and it's not an opioid. It's approved for pediatric use. A call from a doctor and a note from a parent would suffice. The nurse or the trainer would be qualified to administer the shot.
Beth, could you add the trainer to the list of people we're going to interview tomorrow?
Ken asked. Beth nodded and scribbled.
So, Pete said, shall we start at the top? And when I say top, I mean the top floor?
Sure, Ken said.
They followed Pete up the stairs to the mezzanine, which was dotted with more yellow evidence placards labeled with numbers. He began to list the items that had already been photographed.
Here on this old chair, he said, indicating a stool with a ripped cushion, are two Monster energy drinks. We'll be testing the contents. Might be significant given the unusual array of goodies in Mr. McGuire's locker. He led them to the training room and said, after you. Beth and Ken went inside and looked around. Pete showed them the medicine cabinet where Coach Carmen kept her Ketorolac vials and syringes, as well as bandages, gauze, antiseptics, and other first aid items. Her glass vials looked different from the ones in Nick's locker. They had purple tops, white labels with the medicine's name in black, and purple stripes at the bottom. These look legit, Pete said. But you never know. Now, if you'll follow me out to the bloodstained squat rack, which is possibly the aha discovery in this particular investigation. Pete, Beth interrupted as they walked out of the training room. There's a lock on this door. Pardon me? He asked, backtracking. Beth pointed to the lock. The training room has a lock. Because of the medicine, probably, Ken said. No, Beth took a second look inside. The medicine cabinet has a lock of its own. I've been in plenty of training rooms, but I've never seen one with a mechanism like this. This is like a house. It can be locked from the inside or the outside. Pete's boyish face looked flustered. I'll go get my camera, he said. It's downstairs with my case. I'm sorry, I never thought. It's okay, Beth said, patting his shoulder. You do that while I make a quick call. After a second, she said into her phone, yes, hi, Yvonne. Is Mr. Dilly available? I just want to ask him why there's a lock on the training room door. It's very unusual. I'd be interested to know if Mr. Dilly approved it. Of course. She waited for a minute, all the while pacing and looking over the furnishings and contents of the training room. Eventually, she said, hi, yes, I'm still here. Oh, that would be great. Are you sure you don't mind? Wonderful, Yvonne, thank you. Beth hung up and turned to Ken. She has the work order right there on her computer and is going to run it down.
Good, Ken said.
Pete showed back up with his camera and placards and photographed the lock, the door, the cots, and the medicine cabinet. When he'd finished, Ken asked,
so, where were we? The bloody squat rack? That's got a nasty ring to it, doesn't it?
Sure does, Pete said, leading them over.
One thing that the first responder picked up on right away was the injury to the back of Mr. McGuire's head.
Beth nodded, and Ken said,
yes, that's when they called us to come out. Inconsistent with the fall that smashed up the front of his face.
Right, Pete said. So I thought maybe that blow occurred here. Blue Star picked up a lot of blood on this mezzanine. Certainly some is old. Could be training injuries, that sort of thing. But there were a few drops that appeared to be fresh, and then you have this. Pete pointed to one of the top hooks, used to hold the barbell on the squat rack. See that? He asked. Ken and Beth both took a look.
Yep.
Ken said.
That seemed pretty recent, Pete continued, with a trace of hair. I'll be looking at it to see if it matches the blood downstairs on the court.
Once again, Beth was focused on making notes. Ken said,
and if it does, then there was likely an altercation of some sort up here that preceded the fall.
My thoughts exactly, Pete answered brightly. And on that note, should we go down and see where he landed? When they reached the basketball court, Pete showed them the dried blood left behind after Nick had been removed. Mr. McGuire tried to crawl a little bit. There's an indication of a small amount of forward movement in the blood. He was probably trying to get to his phone, which was approximately 18 inches away from his body.
The entrance on the other end of the basketball court opened and closed, and Yvonne came trotting in with a printout. Beth waved to her while Ken and Pete continued to talk.
Wow, Ken whistled. What bad luck. So close. If he'd been able to reach the phone, it would have saved him an entire night of agony alone in the dark, thinking he was going to die.
Well, actually, no, Pete answered. His phone was inoperable. Very smashed up.
Will forensics be able to recover any data from it? Beth asked.
Maybe. Depends on just how bad it is. If he had an iCloud backup or if the phone can still connect to a computer, then yes. If not, and the chip was damaged or the phone needs a total rebuild job, then it's iffy.
Slightly out of breath, Yvonne arrived beside the group and smiled, waiting politely for them to finish talking to hand over the work order. She looked down and noticed that she was standing somewhat close to what appeared to be a crime scene. She made a face and took a few steps back.
This is where Mr. Doyle was found lying next to Mr. McGuire,
Pete said, indicating a spot to the left of the stain.
Looks like the custodian arrived early in the morning, found Mr. McGuire lying here unresponsive, and managed to call 911 before collapsing due to cardiac arrest.
What? Yvonne shouted the word so loudly that the detectives and the technician winced.
Harry! Oh my God, poor Harry! Harry and who else?
Beth made a calming gesture and reached out for the document Yvonne had run down to deliver.
We can't talk about it quite yet, she said. I'm sorry, that really wasn't for you to hear. I'll need you to be discreet for the next couple of days, okay, Yvonne?
Yeah.
Yvonne looked like she was desperate to run out of the gym and go announce the most recent development over the school loudspeaker, but she nodded. Still, she was clearly upset.
Harry?
She asked again.
We all thought it was going to be two moms or two students or a fight between a teacher and a student.
I understand your curiosity, Beth said. All incidents like this are upsetting in their own way.
Is Harry dead?
Yvonne asked.
Ken gave her an empathetic smile.
I think you need to get back to work now, don't you?
Yvonne nodded, still off balance from the news. After she walked away, Ken said to Beth,
How's Mr. Doyle doing, by the way?
As of an hour ago, he was out of the woods, she answered.
Is he already on the list for tomorrow?
He is.
Okay, Ken said. All very interesting. Thank you, Pete. How long do you think it will be before we get a match on the blood and know what's in those vials?
Well, Pete said, I've got a lot to sift through. It's a priority, but frankly, with this storm that's moving in, it could be a slow night. I might be on my own.
Speaking of the storm, Ken, Beth said, Rachel wants to know if I'm coming home tonight or if we're going to be stuck. Ken checked his watch.
We better move pretty quick if we want to make it down the mountain before traffic gets tied up. Let's go speak with Natalie again and leave.
The hour she spent alone in the conference room seemed like an entire day. She found a pencil and a copy of the Falcon Creative Writing Anthology. On the blank page at the back, she sketched her own footprints through the snow, from her car to the door and back to the car. What had she done? What had she seen? Nick was up there with Sloane. She remembered their laughter. What did Sloane know? What did Sloane do? Who was carried out on that second stretcher? For the 100th time, she tried to remember how that first trip into the sports pavilion had ended and came up with nothing but the image of the stairwell and how she'd leaned against the wall and sunk to a seat on the bottom step, feeling as if the world had ended. She assumed the worst. If I killed him, I killed him. If Sloane killed him, she killed him. It was either her or me. Natalie started to sketch Jackson. Jackson, she thought, alone and confused and wondering where Dad was. There were voices outside. The detectives had returned, and Ken was telling the patrol officer that he could go. She slipped the anthology back onto its shelf. After returning to her seat at the conference table, she lowered her face into her hands and wished that she had a pill. Any pill, upper, downer, sideways, she'd take it. When Ken and Beth walked in, they seemed like they were in a hurry, but not to put handcuffs on her, as she'd expected.
Natalie,
Ken said, grabbing his coat off the back of the chair where he'd left it.
That's it for the day. You can go home now.
It was all she could do to keep her jaw from dropping open.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Do you know where the Falcon Valley Police Station is located?
Yes.
The school is closed again tomorrow, and you're going to meet us there at the station at 2:00, okay? Will that work?
Sure.
Natalie glanced at Beth, who was busy pulling on a gray stocking cap and some matching gloves. Beth didn't acknowledge Natalie in the slightest.
You don't have plans to go anywhere special tonight, do you?
Ken asked, zipping up his computer carrying case.
There's a blizzard on the way, she answered. So no.
Her voice sounded like it belonged to someone else. Someone far more timid.
That's good,
Ken said, finally pausing in his end-of-the-day pack-up. He was standing just across the table.
Listen, thank you for all your help. I know it was a long interview. When I see you tomorrow, I'm hoping to have Mr. McGuire's statement, so this inconvenience to your life will be over.
Who? Natalie responded in astonishment. I'm sorry?
Beth dipped her head to hear better as she slipped her arms into her coat sleeves.
Just saying that hopefully by tomorrow this will all be cleared up.
Wait,
Natalie looked completely lost. Who? Who are we talking about? Whose statement did you say?
Mr. McGuire's.
But he's... What? Beth asked, turning around to face Natalie as she adjusted her jacket collar. He's what?
He's dead, Natalie said, standing up, her eyes huge. Isn't he?
Ken put his hands on his hips. His hat was charcoal gray, lined with fur, and had long flaps over the ears. He looked comical and yet still intimidating.
Why would you think Mr. McGuire was dead? Who told you that?
No one had told Natalie he was dead. No one had even told her who exactly had been involved in the accident. She realized she'd made a huge mistake.
The teachers were talking and someone mentioned Nick, she answered, staring at the floor. I thought I heard someone say two bodies, so I guess I just assumed.
Two people went to the hospital, Ken said. Mr. McGuire and Mr. Doyle.
Harry? Natalie asked, gasping.
Ken nodded.
Cardiac arrest shortly after finding Mr. McGuire.
Oh my God, did he?
It looks like Mr. Doyle is going to be okay.
And Nick? Natalie asked. What about Nick?
He's in bad shape, Ken said. Still unconscious, but the doctors expect him to wake up sometime tonight.
Oh, Natalie said, collapsing back into her seat. That's such good news.